Chapter 4. Sustaining Our Agricultural Resources. In October 2018, the scientific journal Nature published a major research report that presented a troubling picture of the future of food, agriculture, and the environment. Credit Springman et al., 2018. The authors of the report, including scientists from the United States, Europe, and Australia, argue that, based on current trends, we will see an increase of 50 to 90% in the negative environmental impacts of food production by the year 2050. Their prediction is based on three key factors. First, as presented in Chapter 3, global population is expected to increase from roughly 7.7 billion people today to almost 10 billion by 2050. Second, the demand for food is actually growing faster than the population is, as rising incomes in countries like China result in more demand for meat and other animal proteins, which require more resources to produce. And third, current agricultural practices are already a significant contributor to major environmental problems, like deforestation, air and water pollution, and global climate change. The Nature report used the planetary boundaries concept described in Chapter 2 to argue that we need to change the way we produce, distribute, and consume food if we are to feed 10 billion people and not ravage the environment. We already use half of Earth's ice-free land surface for grazing livestock and growing crops to feed animals. And 77% of the Earth's land surface has already been developed or modified by human activities, up from just 15% a century ago. Every year, more and more forests, including biodiversity-rich tropical rainforests, are cleared for agriculture. Agriculture uses roughly 70% of global freshwater supplies. Meanwhile, roughly one-third of global food production ends up being discarded as waste each year. This last fact is especially troubling, given that roughly 3 billion people are malnourished and that 1 billion suffer from outright food scarcity and shortages. Given these trends, and given the fact that agriculture and food production are essential human activities, the Nature report focuses on the need to reduce the environmental impact of current agricultural practices. This chapter will contrast the unsustainable approaches to agriculture, which currently dominate, with sustainable approaches that we will need to adopt in the decades ahead. It starts with a brief review of the origins and history of agriculture, and how it has shaped human history through time. This is followed by a review of the basics of soil, climate, and plant growth. We then examine how current agricultural practices are affecting the environment and why these practices are not sustainable. This is followed by a discussion of sustainable agricultural practices, including ideas presented in the Nature report, designed to help us stay within key planetary boundaries. Finally, the chapter will explore the somewhat controversial issue of genetic engineering and genetically modified organisms. Section 4.1: The Origins and History of Agriculture. As discussed in Chapter 3, most of human history occurred during what could be called the pre-agricultural period. Modern humans, or Homo sapiens, have been in existence for roughly 250,000 years. And for 95% of that period, they relied mainly on hunting and gathering to meet their needs for food and sustenance. The beginnings of agriculture. Beginning about 10,000 years ago, however, human societies started to develop and rely on agriculture to meet their needs for food and sustenance. Agriculture is an approach to land management designed to grow domesticated plants and raise domesticated animals for food, fuel, and fiber. Anthropologists believe that this transition from hunter-gatherer to crop domestication and cultivation occurred for a couple of reasons. First, the climate was going through a natural warming cycle after a period of glaciation, and warmer and wetter conditions were more conducive to agriculture. Second, population growth among hunter-gatherer communities may have reached a point at which wild food sources were becoming scarce. Crop domestication and agriculture allowed these communities to grow more food on a given amount of land, and the first crops that were domesticated were easy to grow, dry, and store. Early agriculturists also began to settle in specific locations and to domesticate animals like dogs, goats, sheep, and pigs. Eventually, these more settled communities grew into small villages and even cities, and over the next 8,000 years, the human population of the planet grew from a few million to hundreds of millions of people. Beyond crop selection and plant and animal domestication, other developments and technological advances helped increase agricultural productivity over time. The domestication of cattle was soon followed by the invention of the plow, allowing early farmers to cultivate more land using less human energy. Evidence of irrigation, the deliberate diversion of water to crops, dates back at least 5,000 years, and this helped expand the area under cultivation. Improvements in metal production, crop storage, and transportation also contributed to increased agricultural productivity over thousands of years. Despite these developments, however, agriculture in the year 1500, 1600, or 1700 would have looked similar to what was being practiced 2,000 to 3,000 years before that. Increased land under cultivation allowed for more food production and population growth, but these increases occurred slowly over centuries and millennia. The modernization of agriculture. That situation began to change around the beginning of the industrial period, roughly 200 years ago. The world population was hitting the 1 billion mark, and the Reverend Thomas Malthus argued that human population was growing faster than food production. The result, Malthus predicted, would be increasing starvation, famine, and disease, as well as social collapse, as human numbers outstripped food supply. However, despite some devastating famines in places like Ireland and India, food production was generally able to keep up with a growing population. New lands that had been colonized were put into agricultural production, especially in the Americas, and the invention of agricultural machinery made farming more efficient. At the same time, scientific advances in fields like chemistry, plant genetics, and soil science boosted crop productivity per unit of land. In particular, breakthroughs in the production of synthetic fertilizer in the late 19th century, especially in the production of nitrogen fertilizer on an industrial scale, enabled continued increases in food production. Fertilizers are substances that add nutrients to the soil, thereby encouraging plant growth. While traditional farmers had long made use of available organic material for fertilizer, it's estimated that without the development, mass production, and use of synthetic nitrogen fertilizers, the world's population would never have exceeded 4 billion. Credit Smill, 1997. The Green Revolution. By the 1960s, world population had reached 3 billion people, and another 1 billion were being added every 12 to 14 years. Massive famines in China, sub-Saharan Africa, and southern Asia claimed millions of lives and led to a return of Malthusian thinking about population and food security, whereby everyone has access to an adequate and reliable food supply. It was at this time that ecologist Paul Ehrlich published The Population Bomb, warning of mass starvation and upheaval due to human population growth. However, a series of advances in agricultural production that came to be known as the Green Revolution also occurred. The Green Revolution was not the result of a single scientific breakthrough or technological development, but rather the collective result of a number of changes in the way humans grew food. Plant breeders developed new, high-yielding varieties of wheat, rice, and corn that produced as much as 4 times the amount of grain per acre as conventional varieties. Expanded use of irrigation systems, synthetic fertilizer, and chemical herbicides and pesticides allowed farmers to grow even more crops on the same fields. The results of these changes were dramatic. From 1960 to 2014, global production of the 5 main cereal crops, corn, rice, wheat, barley, and sorghum, increased by an estimated 280%, and yields by an estimated 175%, while the land area devoted to cereal production increased by only 16%. Credit Ritchie, 2017. The challenges of today. Today, we may need another green revolution to keep up with continued population growth, changes in diet, and the environmental impacts of modern, industrialized approaches to agriculture. The impressive increases in yield achieved in the first few decades of the Green Revolution have begun to level off. At the same time, we continue to add roughly 75 million new people to the planet each year. Perhaps more importantly, many of the agricultural practices that emerged during the Green Revolution, including the heavy use of irrigation, synthetic fertilizers, and chemical pesticides, are taking a severe toll on the environment. Rapid advances in science and technology have allowed us to feed a population that has grown from 1 billion to over 7.7 billion in just 200 years. However, there is overwhelming evidence that our current approaches to feeding the world are pushing us close to or beyond planetary boundaries and environmental limits. Clearly, feeding the world as human population reaches 8, 9, or 10 billion will require a change if we are to once again avoid the worst Malthusian predictions of the past. Section 4.2, Characteristics of Industrial Agriculture. The Green Revolution ushered in what is now known as industrial agriculture. These industrialized approaches have enabled food production to keep pace with population growth, but they differ in fundamental ways from the traditional farming practices that were in place for almost 10,000 years. To better understand the environmental impacts of industrialized agriculture and identify more sustainable alternatives to farming, it's instructive to compare industrial agriculture with what is known as traditional agriculture. Agriculture is a necessary part of human civilization, and the challenge will be to combine the technological advances of industrialized agriculture with the sustainable practices of traditional agriculture to feed a growing human population. Linear. First, whereas traditional agricultural practices are based on cyclical systems common in nature, industrial farming is highly linear and modeled on industrial systems. Industrial agriculture is sometimes referred to as factory farming because it's focused mainly on inputs, pesticides, fertilizers, seeds, water, and outputs, corn, wheat, soybeans, meat. The primary goals are to increase production and yield while decreasing costs of production. A traditional farm will likely raise a variety of crops and be home to animals like horses, cows, pigs, chickens, goats, and so on. These animals' waste products in the form of manure are used as fertilizer on crops. Some of those crops are fed to animals, and the cycle begins again. In contrast, an industrial farm will likely focus on raising a single crop. The farmers import, rather than generate on their own farms, seeds, fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, water, and energy for equipment to grow that crop. In the United States and other developed countries, much of the production from these types of farms is soy and corn that is then fed to animals, mainly cows, chickens, and pigs. These animals are then fed to people, and waste products from both the animal production facilities and people are treated in sewage treatment facilities before finally ending up in water bodies, in the case of liquids, or landfills, in the case of solids. After that, the farmer goes back and imports a whole new set of inputs to start the process all over again. Designed to maximize output. Second, whereas traditional agriculture focuses on the production of a wide variety of crops, animals, and other products, industrialized farming is designed to maximize the output of a narrow range of crops. A diversity of crops and animals, sometimes referred to as polyculture farming, better assures the farm family of meeting its needs. At the same time, as will be discussed later in the chapter, this diversity mimics natural systems and is thus better for the environment. Traditional farming also generally includes the management of some trees, a practice known as agroforestry. Trees provide fuel, fruit, nuts, building material, and help with on-farm water retention and management. In contrast, nearly all large-scale agriculture today is based on planting a single crop over large areas of land to maximize productivity. Whereas in the past, a typical farm might produce as many as 10 different agricultural products for market, today, a farm is more likely to grow a single crop like corn or soybeans. Agricultural mechanization, combined with heavy inputs of agricultural chemicals, allows a single farmer to grow the same crop on thousands of acres of land, something that would have been unimaginable just a few generations ago. This kind of agriculture, known as monoculture farming, raises a number of concerns. The over-reliance on a small number of genetically similar crop varieties increases the risk that a widespread insect infestation, crop disease, or fungal infection could wipe out a major global food source. In addition, large-scale monoculture farming tends to reduce the number of farmers and farm families living in rural areas. Some observers have associated this phenomenon with the loss of community and economic diversity in these areas. Credit Union of Concerned Scientists, 2019. Reliant on external inputs. Finally, whereas traditional agriculture tends to be self-sustaining, industrialized farming is heavily reliant on external inputs to survive. Today's industrial farmers depend on chemical pesticides and herbicides to control insects and weeds, and must apply increasing amounts of synthetic fertilizers to maintain crop yields. Industrial farmers also require large amounts of water and fossil fuel energy resources. The environmental impact of these realities will be the focus of much of this chapter, and the chapter will also explore how ideas and practices from traditional agriculture can be incorporated into modern farming to make it more sustainable. Table 4.1 in your ebook offers a brief comparison of industrial and traditional agriculture. Section 4.3, the importance of soil. When most people think of the term soil, they automatically think dirt. And for most people, dirt is considered useless and something to be avoided whenever possible. In reality, soil is much more than dirt, and it is soil that forms the foundation of virtually all land-based food production around the world. Because soil health is so critical to agriculture, sustainable agriculture almost always implies sustainable management of soils. Traditional farming practices tend to carefully manage soil fertility to ensure the ability to grow crops year after year. However, industrialized farming tends to depend on inputs of synthetic fertilizers to compensate for declining soil quality. What is soil? Soil generally consists of five components. Number one, mineral matter, sand, gravel, silt, and clay. Number two, dead organic material. For example, decaying leaves and plant matter. Number three, soil fauna and flora, living bacteria, worms, fungi, and insects. Number four, water. And number five, air. Variations in the levels of these components lead to many different types of soils and soil conditions. Soils that are sandy drain quickly, whereas soils with high clay content hold water and become sticky. Soils with high levels of organic matter tend to be soft and good for plants, whereas compacted soils with few air spaces are less conducive to plant growth. High levels of soil fauna and flora are also generally better able to support plant growth, since these living organisms help decompose dead organic matter and make nutrients available to plants. Most people are surprised that there can be so many living organisms in soil. Far from being lifeless dirt, a small handful of soil can contain millions of bacteria and thousands of fungi and algae. Credit Ingham, 2019. Soils are also habitat for earthworms, ants, mites, sow bugs, centipedes, and other decomposers that make nutrients available to plants. Because soils consist of both living organisms and non-living material that interact to form a more complex whole, they meet the definition of an ecosystem. When we think of soils as ecosystems in and of themselves, we can begin to see why many of the agricultural practices discussed later in the chapter are not sustainable. Soil compaction from heavy farm machinery, regular plowing and manipulation of soils, heavy applications of synthetic fertilizers and chemical herbicides and pesticides, and overuse of irrigation all undermine long-term soil health and threaten the future of agriculture. How is soil made? New soils can form over time and thus might be considered a renewable resource. However, because soil formation is such a slow process, it might be better to think of soils as a finite, limited resource. Soil formation occurs primarily as a result of two basic processes: weathering and the deposition and decomposition of organic matter such as leaves. Weathering is the process of large rocks being worn away or broken down into smaller particles by physical, chemical, and biological forces. Physical weathering occurs through wind, rain, and the expansion and contraction of rocks due to changes in temperature. Chemical weathering is caused when water, gases, or other substances chemically interact with larger rocks and break them apart. Biological weathering is caused by living organisms, such as when tree roots grow and grind against rocks. The deposition and decomposition of organic matter occurs when living organisms drop waste or debris or die. When animals deposit waste or when plants shed leaves and branches, this organic material gets added to the soil. Likewise, when plants, animals, and other living organisms die and drop to the ground, decomposers and detritivores break them down and incorporate that organic material into the soil. The processes of weathering and deposition and decomposition are influenced mainly by climate, topography, and time, allowing soils to form faster in some locations than in others. For example, an inch of new soil can take 50 to 100 years to develop in a healthy grassland ecosystem, whereas the same inch of soil might take 100,000 years to develop in a desert or tundra ecosystem. Soil scientists recognize that soil develops into distinct layers, and they refer to each of these layers as a soil horizon. For our purposes, we can consider five different soil horizons: O, A, B, C, and D. The O, organic horizon, is at the very top and is made up of decomposing plant matter and animal waste that is sometimes referred to as humus. Below this is the A horizon, which is made up of organic matter and mineral particles. The A horizon is where most of the living soil organisms reside, and the upper portions of the A horizon are generally referred to as topsoil. Most plant roots are established in the A horizon, which is why soil health is often based on the condition of topsoil. Below the A horizon is the B horizon, also known as subsoil, and below that is the C horizon, which consists of weathered rock. Finally, the D horizon is known as bedrock. See Figure 4.1 in your ebook. Soil and plant life. Soil conditions have a lot to do with their ability to support plant life and agriculture, and the term soil fertility defines those conditions. Among the most important factors influencing soil fertility are nutrient levels, soil pH, a measure of the acidity or alkalinity of soil, and soil structure. We know from Chapter 2 that nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen can be limiting factors in plant growth. The amount of these and other nutrients in soils is dependent in part on the amount of organic material that is deposited and decomposed in that area. This is why the living organisms, for example, bacteria, fungi, worms, that are found in soil and act as decomposers, are so important to soil fertility. Soil pH is determined by many factors, including the amount of organic material added to soils, the mineral composition of soil particles, and temperature and precipitation levels in that area. Some plants thrive in more acidic soils, whereas others do better in soils that are less acidic or even alkaline. Farmers utilize different soil additives to make soils more or less acidic, depending on the type of crops they want to grow. Lastly, soil structure refers to how much air is in the soil, or how compact it is. Plant roots and the living soil fauna and flora that improve soil fertility need oxygen and other gases to survive. So well-aerated soils tend to be better for plant growth. In contrast, when soils are compacted or compressed, such as through repeated pressure from tractors and heavy farm equipment, they tend to become less aerated and less conducive to plant growth. Highly compacted soils also decrease the ability of water to infiltrate and enter the ground. And as this water runs off the surface, it can carry soil with it. The displacement of this valuable resource, often caused by water or wind, is known as soil erosion. Section 4.4, The Problem of Chemical Pesticides. For as long as humans have farmed, they have had to contend with crop damage and competition from insects, fungus, and weeds. Early agriculturists made some use of chemicals like sulfur, as well as salt, smoke, and other deterrents, to ward off pests. But for the most part, traditional farming relied on more passive approaches to minimize crop loss. For example, by growing a variety of crops and rotating where those crops are grown on the farm, traditional agriculturists created conditions that were not as favorable for the outbreak and growth of pest populations. Likewise, traditional polyculture farming tends to promote and provide habitat for pest predators, like spiders, beetles, predatory mites, and mantids, like the praying mantis, that feed on pests that can damage crops. On the other hand, monoculture farming creates ideal conditions for pest and weed infestations. Because most insect pests are crop-specific, and because monoculture farming grows the same crop season after season over large areas of land, insect pests are able to establish and spread in large numbers. Agricultural pests are organisms that damage or consume crops intended for human use. Agricultural weeds are plants that compete with crops. Of course, weeds and pests don't necessarily see it this way, because they are living organisms attempting to survive. Nevertheless, weeds compete with agricultural crops for sunlight, water, and nutrients. And pests can damage or destroy plant roots, stems, leaves, flowers, and fruit. As a result, industrialized agriculture makes use of a wide variety and a large quantity of chemicals to control weeds and pests. Insecticides kill insects, and herbicides kill weeds. There are also fungicides that kill fungus, as well as rodenticides that kill rodents. These chemicals are collectively known as pesticides. The agricultural chemical industry has developed thousands of pesticides in the past 50 to 60 years, and it's estimated that we apply close to 454 million kilograms, or 1 billion pounds, of pesticides in the United States each year. Credit Alavanja, 2009. Roughly 80% of this pesticide is applied to farm fields, with the other 20% applied to backyard lawns, gardens, golf courses, and parks. It's also estimated that over 95% of all corn and soybean crops planted in the United States are treated with herbicides each year. Credit Wexler and Fernandez Cornejo, 2016. Whereas cotton is probably the most intensive user of chemical insecticides. Credit Cuby, 2006. Biomagnification. One of the earliest chemical pesticides to come into widespread use was a compound known as dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, or DDT. First developed in the late 1930s, DDT was seen to be an inexpensive, stable, and highly effective insecticide that was also relatively non-toxic to humans and other mammals. Because DDT was a broad-spectrum insecticide, meaning it could kill a wide variety of insects, it quickly became popular among farmers for controlling crop pests, as well as mosquitoes and household insect pests. After more than a decade of widespread use, however, in the 1950s it began to become apparent that DDT might be causing unintended environmental consequences. Because DDT is a long-lived and stable compound, it gradually built up in soils and water bodies. Because DDT is fat-soluble and attaches itself to body fats when ingested, it was also building up in populations of wild fish, birds, reptiles, and other organisms. This poses a particular problem for animals near the top of the food chain. For example, DDT sprayed on agricultural fields will eventually flow into streams or lakes, where it could be ingested by tiny zooplankton. These organisms are then eaten by small fish, thereby accumulating all the DDT in the zooplankton. Small fish are then eaten by larger fish that are then eaten by birds of prey like falcons, bald eagles, and pelicans. Recall from Chapter 2 that only about 10% of the energy consumed at one trophic level is available to the next level. This means that birds of prey, like the bald eagle, have to eat a lot of fish to have sufficient energy. As birds eat, the DDT in fish becomes more and more concentrated in the birds. The increasing concentration of a chemical pesticide at higher levels of the food chain is known as biomagnification. By the late 1950s and early 1960s, populations of birds of prey were declining dramatically, and the cause was linked to high concentrations of DDT. It turns out that DDT was not killing the birds outright, but rather altering the way calcium was metabolized in their bodies. This resulted in a thinning of bird eggshells and low survival rates for chicks. The 1962 publication of the book Silent Spring by ecologist Rachel Carson drew attention to this unfolding disaster and eventually helped lead to the banning of DDT in most developed countries. Resistance. Today, the agricultural chemical industry has learned some lessons from the experience with DDT. Newer varieties of pesticides are designed to be short-lived and less stable in the environment, so that they break down quickly after use. They are also designed to be more targeted at specific species and applied at specific times when target pests are most vulnerable. Nevertheless, a number of other environmental problems still remain with widespread pesticide use. First, because insects breed rapidly, they can develop genetic resistance to insecticides within a relatively short time. In other words, the insecticide will wipe out most of the pests initially, but the ones that survived will multiply, and the insecticide will become less effective with each successive generation. See Figure 4.2 in your ebook. Likewise, weeds can also develop resistance to herbicides over time. Heavy applications of chemical pesticides will initially help control insects and weeds, but over time, they prove less and less effective as these organisms develop a resistance. It's estimated that since the start of widespread chemical pesticide use in the late 1940s, over 500 species of insects, credit Gutt, Schilder, Isaacs, and McManus, 2015, and 500 species of weeds, credit Heap, 2019, have developed chemical resistance, prompting what is known as pest resurgence. Farmers are then forced into what some call a pesticide treadmill, or pesticide arms race, and must spend money on either larger doses of pesticides or new varieties of the chemicals. And despite the fact that synthetic pesticide use has seen a 50-fold increase since 1950, and that today's pesticides are 10 to 100 times more toxic to pests than those used in the past, credit Roser and Ritchie, ND, Gross, 2019. It's estimated that we still lose over 40% of major crops to pests and crop diseases each year, a higher proportion than in 1950. Credit Elliott, 2015, Fernandez, Cornejo, et al., 2014. Threat to biodiversity. Another major environmental problem associated with the widespread use of chemical pesticides in agriculture is the impact these chemicals have on non-target species and biodiversity. The case of DDT and its impact on birds like the bald eagle was an early and high-profile example of this problem. Today, there continue to be concerns over the impact of pesticides on natural predators, other wildlife, and biodiversity generally, even if it doesn't involve a species as well known as the bald eagle. Some of the non-target species whose populations are reduced or eliminated by chemical insecticides include the spiders, beetles, and mantids that help control insect pests in traditional agricultural systems. One particular area of concern involves the impacts that some pesticides appear to be having on bee colonies around the world. A newer class of chemical compounds developed in the 1990s, known as neonicotinoid pesticides, are now the most widely used form of insecticides globally. These chemicals appear to be responsible for significant declines in honeybee populations in agricultural regions, and for the complete collapse of honeybee colonies through a process known as colony collapse disorder. This development is a significant concern because honeybees provide a critical ecosystem function by pollinating many major vegetable and fruit crops, including tomatoes, peppers, apples, and almonds. In addition to impacting honeybees, neonicotinoid pesticides appear to be negatively affecting a variety of bird and fish species as well. Threat to human health. Lastly, chemical pesticides can pose a threat to human health. The World Health Organization, or WHO, estimates that every year, at least 3 million agricultural workers are directly poisoned through improper handling of and exposure to chemical pesticides, which results in over 250,000 deaths a year. Credit WHO, NDA. Every year, the Environmental Working Group, or EWG, publishes a Shopper's Guide to Pesticides in Produce, which estimates levels of pesticide residues found on fruits and vegetables sold in grocery stores around the United States. The 2019 EWG list ranked strawberries, spinach, kale, nectarines, apples, grapes, peaches, cherries, pears, tomatoes, celery, and potatoes as the Dirty Dozen in terms of levels of pesticide residues. Credit EWG 2019A. While the link between exposure to pesticide residues from food and cancer or other health problems is complicated, a number of studies suggest that people with less exposure have fewer of these problems. Credit Baudry et al., 2018, Chu et al., 2018. It's also estimated that well over 90% of chemical pesticides sprayed on crops never reach the target insects they were intended for. Credit Duke, 2017. Instead, they drift through the air, run off into streams and lakes, or seep into groundwater, water found underground in soil or in the pores and crevices of rock. These chemicals can then be inhaled by people or ingested through drinking water. Agricultural chemicals like glyphosate, trade name Roundup, malathion, and atrazine have been found in municipal water supplies and in private wells, especially in heavily agricultural areas. These and other chemicals have been linked to human health problems, such as infertility, low sperm count, and prostate and testicular cancers. Overall, chemical pesticides have become a virtual necessity in industrialized agriculture because of the perfect conditions created for pests and weeds in monoculture farming. However, the heavy use of these chemicals is proving less effective over time as insect pests and weeds develop greater resistance to them. Furthermore, herbicides and pesticides are having negative impacts on non-target species of animals and are also implicated in a variety of negative human health impacts. Section 4.5, the problem of synthetic fertilizers and poor soil management. Just as industrialized monoculture farming requires chemical pesticides, it also relies on synthetic fertilizers. Raising the same crop year after year quickly depletes soils of specific nutrients and requires the application of synthetic fertilizers to maintain crop yields. Traditional farmers use substances already produced on their farms. Applying animal manure or compost, or plowing under old crops to enhance soil fertility. In contrast, industrialized farmers apply over 109 million metric tons of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer alone to crop fields each year. Credit Pierce, 2018b. This dependence on synthetic fertilizers is a symptom of the linear approach to agriculture, which views soil as simply one input to the production process, rather than the complex living ecosystem that it actually represents. Heavy fertilizer use and poor soil management can result in serious environmental problems, including pollution of groundwater supplies, nutrient runoff and eutrophication, and soil erosion and land degradation. Water pollution. Industrialized farming operations tend to spray more chemical pesticides than needed, and also tend to apply more fertilizer than plants can make use of. This excess nitrogen fertilizer, in the form of nitrate, can make its way through soils and into groundwater deposits. This nitrate pollution can persist in the water supply and build up over time as more and more nitrogen fertilizer gets applied to farm fields. While nitrate pollution in groundwater is not a major health threat for adults, it can cause low oxygen levels in the blood of infants and children and result in a potentially fatal condition known as blue baby syndrome. Large areas of the agricultural Midwest, including much of Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas, have both high levels of nitrogen fertilizer application and vulnerable aquifers that provide drinking water to the general population. As a result, many of these areas are at high risk of groundwater contamination by nitrate. In addition to groundwater pollution, excess fertilizer from farms can contribute to the pollution problem known as eutrophication. Recall the case study in Section 2.4. Excess nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers run off of farm fields, as well as residential lawns, golf courses, and parks, into bodies of water, where they fertilize aquatic plant growth and create algae blooms. This aquatic plant life, or phytoplankton, builds up and eventually sinks to the bottom, where it is decomposed by bacteria that use up the dissolved oxygen in the water. This results in low oxygen or hypoxic conditions that can lead to the death and displacement of fish and other aquatic life, and eventually to the formation of low oxygen areas known as dead zones. As we learned in Section 2.4, the Gulf of Mexico dead zone is the largest such area in the United States, and the formation of this dead zone is linked directly to the large quantities of nitrogen and phosphorus flowing from the agricultural Midwest into the Gulf. Topsoil erosion. While some soil erosion occurs naturally, industrialized agricultural practices greatly speed up this process. Water is the primary cause of soil erosion from most farm fields. Because most forms of industrialized agriculture involve plowing and clearing the land of vegetation, even small amounts of rain can move soil particles off a field, since there are no roots or organic material to hold them in place. Mechanization and the use of heavy farm equipment compacts soils and requires more frequent plowing and manipulation of soils, which can worsen erosion and further deplete the soil of nutrients. This type of gradual, almost imperceptible loss of topsoil is known as sheet erosion. Heavier rains can create small streams of water or rivulets that wash even greater amounts of soil off fields in a process known as rill erosion. In more extreme cases, these small streams of water can merge to form large streams that can gouge out large channels from fields in a process known as gully erosion. Soil erosion not only reduces soil fertility and crop productivity, it also creates water pollution and sedimentation problems in rivers, streams, and lakes. In addition to water, heavy winds can loosen and blow topsoil off farm fields, especially in places that are dry and flat. The 1930s Dust Bowl in prairie areas of the United States and Canada was a result of drought conditions and removal of trees and other ground cover to expand farm area. While not as dramatic as images from the 1930s, windblown soil erosion continues to be a major problem in the United States today, and scientists cannot rule out the return of Dust Bowl conditions in periods of severe drought. In drier regions of Asia and Africa, overgrazing of livestock and clearance of vegetation is allowing desert areas to expand in a process known as desertification. Over the past 3 decades, China has lost a land area the size of Indiana to desertification. As the Gobi Desert encroaches into areas that were previously suitable for some forms of agriculture. Air pollution and climate change. Excessive use of nitrogen fertilizer can also contribute to air pollution. Ammonia gas from nitrogen fertilizer application can contribute to haze great distances from where the fertilizer is being applied. Nitrous oxide gas can also form in soils fertilized with nitrogen fertilizer. Nitrous oxide is a local, regional air pollutant and also contributes to global climate change and even ozone depletion, discussed in Chapter 8. It's estimated that 2/3 of global nitrous oxide emissions from human activities are a result of agriculture. Ammonia and nitrous oxide can react with other compounds in the atmosphere to form fine particulate pollution. These particulates are responsible for haze and are also a public health risk when inhaled into the lungs. Wind erosion of farmlands can carry soil particles into the air and also contribute to particulate pollution. Overall, heavy application of agricultural fertilizers and poor soil management practices are resulting in the degradation of 2 key forms of natural capital, water and soil. Excess fertilizer can seep into groundwater or run off into surface water and result in drinking water pollution, eutrophication, and aquatic dead zones. Soil erosion by water and wind can reduce soil quality and contribute directly to water pollution. Section 4.6, the dependence on water and non-renewable energy. Unlike traditional agricultural systems that make relatively limited use of external inputs and are powered primarily by energy from the sun through photosynthesis, modern industrialized agriculture is heavily reliant on external inputs of water and fossil fuel energy resources. Traditional agricultural systems and approaches are generally tailored to local conditions. For example, farmers in regions with less precipitation and more frequent droughts know to depend to a greater extent on crops that require less water and that are drought-resistant. Likewise, the cyclical approaches used in traditional agriculture, including the use of animal manure, composting, and crop rotation, are designed to make the most of resources that are already on the farm, rather than importing them. In contrast, the highly linear approach to industrialized agriculture enables farmers to ignore local climate conditions and essentially import large amounts of water and fossil fuel energy to produce a monoculture crop. Impact of water consumption. Agriculture is the single largest user of water globally, accounting for roughly 80% of all water use in the United States and over 90% in most Western states. Credit USDA, 2019. Large-scale irrigation systems allow modern farmers to grow crops in certain regions where it would otherwise not be possible to do so, such as rice production in desert regions of Arizona. Roughly 40% of world food production comes from land that is artificially irrigated. Credit Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, 2014. And demand for irrigation water is projected to continue to increase in the future. One area of concern associated with agriculture's heavy dependence on water is the overextraction of groundwater. Overextraction occurs when water is pumped out of an underground aquifer, an underground layer of water-bearing rock, at a rate that exceeds natural recharge or replenishment of that supply. If you think of an underground aquifer as a bathtub or basin filled with water, the rate of extraction would be water going down the drain, while the rate of recharge would be water coming out of the tap and into the basin. Obviously, if more water is going down the drain than coming from the tap, the water level in the basin will go down, That is exactly what is happening in many key agricultural areas around the world today, especially in parts of North Africa, Southern Asia, China, and the United States. Many aquifers in these regions contain fossil water that was deposited there over geological timescales. Heavy extraction of water from these deposits is not offset by new water recharge, and as a result, water levels are dropping dramatically. As water levels drop, the land above it can sink or subside. Overextraction of groundwater in coastal areas can also allow salt water from the sea to intrude into freshwater aquifers, making them unsuitable for residential or agricultural uses. Another environmental problem associated with overuse of irrigation water in agriculture is soil salinization. Most irrigation water contains small or trace amounts of salts from the rocks and underground aquifers. When irrigation water is applied to farm fields, some of the water evaporates, leaving a tiny residue of salt behind. Over time, as more and more water gets added to a field and evaporates, more of the salt particles can build up in the soil. Soil salinization can lower crop yields and damage or even kill some crop plants. It's estimated that over 20% of all irrigated cropland, mostly in dry areas, is impacted by soil salinization, and that the damage to crop productivity is over $25 billion each year. Credit United Nations University, 2014. Impact of fossil fuel consumption. Energy use in agriculture is both direct and indirect. Direct energy consumption includes the diesel fuel, propane, electricity, and other forms of energy used to power tractors, harvesters, pumps, lights, dryers, and other forms of farm equipment. Indirect energy consumption includes the energy used to transport crops, process foods, and produce the fertilizers and other agricultural chemicals used in farming. It's estimated that direct and indirect forms of energy consumption in agriculture account for 19% of all energy use in the United States each year. Credit Pimentel, 2006. Agriculture's contribution to global climate change results from emissions of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide. Carbon dioxide emissions from agriculture happen directly as a result of burning diesel, propane, and other fossil fuels to power farm machinery and equipment. Carbon dioxide is also released when forests are cut and burned to make way for agricultural production. Agriculture is also a major producer of methane from livestock operations and rice farming, as well as nitrous oxide from fertilizer use. Overall, it's estimated that the global food system, including growing, processing, and transporting crops, is responsible for up to one-third of human-caused greenhouse gas emissions. Credit Gilbert, 2012. Section 4.7. The issues with animal and meat production. The global meat and dairy industry is massive and growing. Worldwide, the livestock sector produces roughly 120 million metric tons of poultry, 120 million metric tons of pork, 72 million metric tons of beef and veal, 15 million metric tons of meat from sheep and goats, and 827 million metric tons of milk and milk products each year. Credit Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, 2018A. If divided equally among all of the people around the world, this would result in an average global consumption of roughly 42 kilograms or 92 pounds of meat per person and 107 kilograms or 237 pounds of milk and milk products per person per year. In reality, levels of meat and milk consumption are highly uneven. For example, the average American or Australian eats over 90 kilograms, or 200 pounds of meat per year. The average person in China or Vietnam eats about 50 kilograms, or 110 pounds a year. And the average Ethiopian, Indian, or Bangladeshi eats less than 4 kilograms, or 9 pounds per year. Credit Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, 2018A. Producing meat and dairy products has a large environmental footprint. And as developing countries become wealthier, it's expected that their citizens will incorporate more of these foods into their diets. This will likely aggravate some of the major environmental issues associated with meat and dairy production, including managing animal waste, preventing pollution, and dealing with antibiotic resistance. Feeding our food. Before we discuss the direct environmental impact of the meat and dairy industries, it's important to understand the basic inefficiencies in our current system. To start, a significant portion of the commercial crops grown on industrialized farms around the world is fed directly to animals rather than to humans. In the United States, after excluding corn grown for ethanol production, 50% of corn is fed to cattle, pigs, and chicken. Credit USDA, 2015B. Over 70% of the soybeans grown in the United States are for animal feed, mostly for chicken production. Credit USDA, 2015C. When looked at this way, we can link virtually all of the environmental problems associated with agriculture to animal and meat production. Heavy use of chemical pesticides, overapplication of fertilizers, soil erosion and land degradation, water pollution and aquatic dead zones, air pollution, and global climate change can all be linked to the agricultural production of crops like corn and soy that are fed to animals. In addition, feeding grains to animals that are then fed to humans is an inefficient way to feed the world. Farm animals are fed well over 1 billion metric tons of grain a year, and roughly 80% of all farmland is utilized for raising animals or growing crops to feed animals. Credit Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, 2019. And yet, meat and dairy account for just 18% of calories and 37% of protein consumed by humans each year. For example, it takes as much as 24 kilograms, or 53 pounds of grain, in the form of animal feed to produce 1 kilogram, or 2.2 pounds of beef. For pork, that figure is roughly 4 to 1, and for chicken, about 3 to 1, as illustrated in figure 4.3 in your ebook. Credit Worsenius, Azar, and Berndes, 2010. This basic inefficiency associated with meat production and consumption lies at the heart of debates over how to feed a global population on track to hit 10 billion in the next few decades. Waste management problems. Many of the environmental and health issues associated with large-scale, industrialized approaches to meat production have to do with how these animals are raised. Today, most of the chicken, pork, and beef consumed in developed countries like the United States originates from what are known as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. The USDA defines a CAFO as an animal feeding operation with at least 1,000 animal units confined for at least 45 days a year. Because an animal unit equates to 454 kilograms or 1,000 pounds of live animal weight, the USDA definition of a CAFO describes an animal feeding operation that has at least 1,000 cattle, 2,500 pigs, 55,000 turkeys, or 125,000 chickens. In 2016, it was estimated that there were just under 20,000 CAFOs in the United States. Credit USDA, ND. One benefit of CAFOs is that they bring many animals together in one concentrated location, instead of requiring a larger land area for grazing. This has the potential to cut down on overgrazing and soil erosion. However, concentrating so many animals together in a small space can create serious problems with waste management. For example, an average cow can produce about 30 kilograms, or 66 pounds of manure per day, or 11 metric tons each year. A CAFO with 1,000 cows, most CAFOs are much larger than this, produces as much waste as a city of 10,000 people. Nationwide, annual production of animal waste from the meat industry is as much as 20 times greater than waste produced by humans. Credit Prybar, 2010. Environmental and health problems stem from both the sheer volume of waste and how this waste is handled. Typically, animal waste from CAFOs is mixed with water to form a liquid slurry and simply stored in open pits or lagoons to decompose over time. In traditional approaches to agriculture, this waste could potentially serve as valuable fertilizer for crops. However, in the case of CAFOs, there's often simply too much waste in one location to be utilized on local farm fields. Also, because animals in CAFOs are often fed antibiotics and grain treated with pesticides, their waste is often so contaminated that it is dangerous to apply it to the soil. Nevertheless, it's estimated that about half of the animal waste collected from CAFOs is applied to nearby farm fields. Some of this manure slurry runs off of fields and into nearby rivers, streams, and other waterways, where it can cause eutrophication and also contaminate drinking water supplies with bacteria and pathogens. Some manure slurry stored in open pits and lagoons can seep through the soil and into groundwater deposits. In other cases, heavy rains and flooding can cause these waste lagoons to overflow or even break open, dumping massive amounts of concentrated animal waste into nearby rivers and streams. When Hurricane Florence hit North Carolina in September 2018, hundreds of hog farm manure lagoons either overflowed or failed completely, severely contaminating nearby drinking water supplies. Credit Pierre Lewis, 2018. In addition to water pollution, CAFO waste management practices contribute to air pollution. Manure lagoons and open pits found in CAFOs emit many different types of gases, including some, like ammonia and hydrogen sulfide, that could be hazardous to human health in the immediate area. Many of these gaseous emissions from CAFOs are also foul-smelling, and they can reduce quality of life and property values for nearby residents. CAFOs are also a major source of greenhouse gas emissions, especially methane, that contribute to global climate change. These methane emissions come from the digestive systems of cows being raised for meat and from the breakdown of organic wastes in the manure lagoons found in CAFOs. It's estimated that raising livestock is responsible for about 36% of methane emissions worldwide and for about 18% of all greenhouse gas emissions. Credit U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, 2019. As demand for meat and dairy increases worldwide, these greenhouse gas emissions are also expected to increase and further worsen rates of global climate change. Antibiotic resistance. Because CAFOs confine so many animals together in a relatively small space, they create ideal conditions for the spread of infections and diseases among the animals. As a result, CAFOs have historically made heavy use of antibiotics to try to prevent illness, and to treat animals that are already sick. It's estimated that roughly 70% of medically important antibiotics used in the United States each year are for animal production. Credit Dahl, 2016. However, recent changes in federal guidelines governing antibiotic use in animals, combined with growing public concern over the dangers of antibiotic resistance, appear to be resulting in declines in antibiotic use in animal feeding operations. Credit Dahl, 2018. While in the short term, this antibiotic use helps cut down on disease and increases productivity, it has a serious long-term consequence. Just as the overuse of pesticides and herbicides has led to the development of resistant insects and weeds, overuse of antibiotics results in the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria and disease organisms. See Figure 4.4 in your ebook. These antibiotic-resistant bacteria can contaminate human food supplies as the animals are slaughtered and can spread to drinking water supplies when manure lagoons overflow or seep into groundwater. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, has now established clear links between heavy antibiotic use in CAFOs and a rapid rise in antibiotic-resistant bacteria, including Salmonella and E. coli. Credit 2018. As a result, the CDC and other public health experts have been calling for a phase-out of routine antibiotic use in animal feeding operations, while the meat industry has resisted and pointed to the benefits of antibiotic use on productivity.